Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Annika Schmeding's new book, Sufi Civilities, Religious Authority and Political Change in Afghanistan, is a deeply sensitive and rich study of a variety of facets of Sufism in contemporary Afghanistan. Focused on the intersection and interaction of Sufism and Afghan civil society, this book simultaneously offers a layered and often moving account of Sufism in Afghanistan, while also presenting an excellent critique of Western NGO-driven understandings of civility and civil society. The book also engages a number of themes connected to Sufism in Afghanistan, including Sufism and the state, gender in Sufism, Sufis and the ulama, and Sufi religious authority through the oniric imagination. This wonderfully written book will also be a pleasure to teach in the classroom. Here now is my conversation with Professor Annika Schmeding. Hello, Annika. Welcome to the New Books Network. Real pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And this was such a great pleasure reading this this text, you know, both for scholars and teachers of Sufism and South Asia and Afghanistan and Islam. There is so much there, both in terms of research and in terms of possible use in the classroom. So really excited about talking to you about this fantastic new book. We have a tradition on the New Books Network, Annika, that our first question is always biographical. So I was wondering if briefly you could share a bit with our listeners your journey or story about how you became a scholar.
Sure. So I think there's a very short answer and there's a longer answer to that. I guess the short answer would be curiosity and learning from everyone. And the longer answer is, of course, the combination of my own studies and then spending time in the places where I directly learned from people. So I studied cultural anthropology, political science, and comparative literature in Berlin. And I took a semester off to hitchhike to Pakistan and study there at the university for one semester in Islamabad. And while I was there, I realized that what I was learning by being in the place actually explained to me so much more what anthropology was about, what kind of questions one could ask and approach through anthropology. And so I decided that I wanted to just spend more time actually in the region to understand better actually what I was studying at university. And so I decided to take a year off between my BA and MA, and I moved to Afghanistan. So that was in 2011. I took on a job as an intern in the Afghan government. And following that, I initially worked in NGOs, but also for an Afghan circus project. And I realized that there was so much complexity, so much that I wanted to understand better. So I went back to Europe, did a master's in Middle East area studies at Leiden, where I also started properly learning Persian and Pashto and immersing myself in the history of Afghanistan and the region. I returned for field research in 2013-14, and I decided that I wanted to pursue a PhD in anthropology at Boston University, which would give me the time to properly understand more facets of what was going on around me and what I was studying. And so initially my research was not on Sufi communities. I actually researched initially on nomadic communities in Afghanistan. But during one of the research trips to Afghanistan, an NGO for which I was also conducting some research for the European Union, they got attacked. And during the time when I was kind of rethinking of whether and what kind of research I actually wanted to do, I had a very insightful conversation with an Afghan friend of mine. And it came from that experience, actually, that I mentioned earlier from having spent time in Turkey, Syria, Iran, Pakistan, which are all countries with a sizable Sufi presence and also, of course, literature about Sufism in these countries. And I was sitting over lunch with my Afghan friend, Ruhullah, who was at the time a director of a research institute there. And I asked him what had actually happened to Sufis in Afghanistan, because, of course, we knew Afghanistan as a place which being the cradle of mystic interpretation of Islam. Of course, also with the origin of Maulana Jalaluddin Balkhi in the West as Rumi. But I'm wondering, like, okay, so what actually happened to these communities in these last decades? And so he basically just laughed at me and said, like, well, they're all still here. You foreigners just don't ask about them because all that you care about is gender, counterinsurgency, and nation building. And so I kind of took that to heart and decided to research this book, which is basically a very delayed answer to this discussion with my friend, in which I then went on to, on the one hand, first do my dissertation and then also my postdoc, in which I later on wrote this book that you have now read about the experiences of Sufi communities during particularly these last 20 years of military intervention slash occupation, but also the longer history of kind of the last 4 to 5 decades of experiences that Sufi communities have had in Afghanistan.
Perfect. I thought one way to sort of dive into the book might be to talk about the title of the book to do with Sufi civilities. And, you know, one key aspect of this book and one key aspect of the framing of this book is this, what one might call the intersection, but also the interaction between Sufism and Afghan civil society. And you make it a point to use this case study to critique sort of Western NGO-dominated notions of what is civil society. So I was wondering, maybe we can begin with that. Could you speak a bit about this underlying theme of the book in terms of the relationship between civility and Sufism, or civil society and Sufism in Afghanistan? Could you explain that a bit for our listeners?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So my main argument is that by using Sufism to look at Afghanistan, kind of a crucial part of Afghanistan's history and society, but also civil space comes into view when we apply this lens. And this intersection of Sufism and civil society actually came into view for me, not from a literature lens at first, but actually from an experiential lens. So it came from an experience that I had at a Sufi gathering in Kabul, where one of the participants, and this is also how I start the book, joked about this to me and says, this is actually the real Afghan civil society, what we're experiencing here in this Sufi gathering. And when she said that, it kind of struck me for several reasons. So at the time of my research, of course, civil society had become a special interest in the kind of neoliberal development policy that was driving the post-2001 state building process in Afghanistan. And interestingly, actually, the woman who made that comment, she was herself a part of that. So she was a director of a large NGO. She was interfacing with a lot of international donors. But she actually meant that what is actually missing when we see when we see civil society as only NGOs, we're actually missing a really crucial part of what the civil space is in Afghanistan. And her critique actually is the critique of seeing these civil society, particularly as NGOs that are largely English speaking, that are mainly doing service delivery as well in the development and reconstruction sector. And of course, that's not uncommon in the global development sector, where of course, technically oriented NGOs take over the job of aid delivery. But what is, of course, furthermore happening, or was happening in Afghanistan, was that these civil society actors or organizations were also framed as central to the post-2001 peace and state building process as an attempt to also humanize the war. So they were actually seen by particular actors, such as military elites in the United States, as a kind of force multiplier or as a part of the combat team. So the kind of like linking up of this kind of civil society also with counterinsurgency. So the joke of that woman who was attending that Sufi poetry gathering was actually targeted at this particular way of understanding civil society, which is rather limited because Afghanistan, of course, has never been without its own civil society sphere. So there's been always in the more informal sector, people who are coming together on a volunteer basis to improve infrastructure, to support people in need, or to mediate disputes. And so once I started actually looking at these Sufi communities in these ways, I also found, of course, ample evidence in, of course, the general more history of Islam, right? When we look at Armando Salvatore's work, for example, who has argued that Sufi lodges historically have always been, you know, important meeting points that established social bonds between not only the master and disciple, but also between students. They were always sanctuaries for long distance travelers. Peers regularly were recruited to mediate and resolve problems. And Sufi orders in many ways connected a wide variety of individuals, such as social classes, and also made connections between different regions. So my argument therefore builds on that. And I use Sufism as a lens through which to better understand Afghanistan's society, and also builds on work by anthropologists who have questioned this narrow usage of the term civil society, and opted instead for a more expanded definition of what they term civility. So the term itself, civility, can be quite misleading, of course, because I do not mean to with that a kind of morality or manners or civic virtue. So I'm not trying to measure the kind of civicness of Sufi adherents or how faithful they are. But I'm using it to kind of analyze the social networks of trust that are created by these Sufi communities. And so what I mean by that is that they actually fulfill a lot of important functions in society. So there's, of course, aspects of socialization, public communication of ideas, social security. There's, of course, as well the distribution of resources, of food, for example, at those Sufi lodges as well. And as already mentioned before, the kind of mediation and conflict resolution. And so if you look at Sufi communities in this way, then we can see these kind of changes and continuities in different areas of society, such as religious education, questions of how national heritage is negotiated, but also the kind of space that lets people voice divergent opinions or tolerate coexistence. So it's also a way to look at how discourses are shifting within society.
Terrific. The next question I want to ask before we get more into some of the specifics of the individual chapters is that, you know, of course, one ought not to over-romanticize or sort of pigeonhole the specificity of any context. But this ethnographic project was conducted in rather extraordinary times in Afghanistan. And there are not many ethnographies, especially in relation to Afghanistan's religious sort of present that we have in the Western Academy. So I just wanted to ask you a bit about the experience of conducting an ethnographic project in a site like Afghanistan, some of the potentialities, but also some of the challenges of ethnographic work in a context that is so underexplored in the Western Academy. Could you very briefly talk a bit about the experience of ethnography before we get to some specific issues in relation to the chapters of the book?
So I approached Sufi communities from an anthropological perspective, which means that I was looking at the networks of Sufi teachers and students, their sociality, but also their politics of interaction with each other and with outsiders. And I did that with a number of different, very typical, I would say, anthropological methodologies. I did qualitative interviews. I did participant observation. I also looked at private archives of some of these communities. But what, of course, is maybe a bit more special to conflict settings, of course, is the question of how to conduct the research safely for both the different people that I was interfacing with and for their wider community as well. One of the responses for that for me was to conduct the research in multiple sites. So I did multi-sided research in Herat and in Kabul, so in two of the major cities in Afghanistan. And so I was spending some time in the communities, going to, you know, weekly gatherings and teachings, attending annual celebrations, or attending zikr sessions, and videotaping and photographing speeches, pretty much like the usual things that I think any anthropologist would do to conduct this kind of research. But of course, one of the things that maybe is special for most of conflict or post-conflict environments is the kind of dialogue with many interlocutors about what they consider as safe or safe way of interacting with each other. Because there's a constantly changing security situation, of course, around us. And so sometimes that actually meant that I couldn't spend very long time in one place, or it changed how long time I could actually spend in communities. And of course, it's also a situation where there is a very open dialogue then with the communities that I research about what is safe for them to share with me, or what should I write about and in which way. So I did a lot what is often termed dialogical writing. So I would be writing already parts of what I wanted to include later on in my dissertation or for the book, and I would be showing it to some of my interlocutors and getting their insights into whether and how I was writing about them actually not only felt congruent with how they were experiencing it, but also whether that was actually safe to name certain things, or, you know, to write about in that sense, also if it became public in an environment that also is quite polarized around some of the issues that I was writing about. So I think in that sense, a lot of the difficulties of experiencing research in Afghanistan are comparable to other conflict zones. And I believe that there has been always actually a lot of room to actually conduct underground research in Afghanistan. Which a lot of times is more complicated also by institutions in the Western Academy of actually letting researchers go to those places and doing that responsibly. So I think that there is actually a need for having a broader discussion about this, how to conduct this research to keep both the researcher, but also the research community with whom we are doing this research safe in the way that we're doing the research.
Let's come to the first chapter, in which the main theme is the relationship between Sufism and the state, and Sufi groups and the state. And here, I think perhaps I thought the most useful way to talk about this for our listeners might be to talk about these three main categories that you talk about in terms of conceptualizing this relationship: what you call state alignment, resistance, and strategic distance. Could you explain a bit to our listeners what you mean by these three categories and how they shed light on some of the ambivalences of this relationship between Sufism and the state in Afghanistan?
Great question. Thank you for that. So my take on the relationship between Sufi leaders and their community vis-a-vis the state comes from this question: how Sufi communities have dealt historically, but also more contemporaneously, with this ever-changing political circumstances that they found themselves in. So I believe most listeners would know maybe most about, you know, the last 20 years with international intervention / occupation and counterinsurgency operation and terror attacks. But of course, there's a much longer history already of revolutions and coups and rapidly changing socioeconomic conditions, the Soviet invasion, of course, before that in the late 1970s and 1979. So there are a lot of drastic changes that Sufi communities have lived through. And so I looked into how can we actually understand the relationship then from like Sufi leaders and their communities vis-a-vis the state. Historians, of course, have cautioned that there's not one particular Sufi approach to politics per se. But what I found when I looked into the historiography and my own oral history interviews was that Sufi communities have shown a remarkable dexterity in their ability to adapt. And in fact, I would actually say that their dexterity itself is the framework. So their way to adapt in these multiple ways towards these changing political circumstances. And I propose these three relational types that you just mentioned: the state alignment, resistant, and a third, which I term strategic distance. And so These three approaches, of course, do not map neatly onto particular actors or groups, but they are adopted circumstantially as the environment shifts and changes. So the first one, state alignment, is maybe one that a lot of historians would be very familiar with, because over the centuries, many rulers in various parts of the world have attached themselves to Sufi peers or followed their guidance. Of course, we know examples of the Ottoman Empire with the Mevlevis, or the Iranian Safavid dynasty with the Safaviyya order, or Timurid Empire with the Naqshbandiya Sheikh Abdurrahman Jami. So there's many different examples of this. And in Afghanistan, in the more recent history, state alignment is visible, for example, through prominent Sufi state alliances of the Gailani family, who belong to the Qadiriyya Sufi order, and the Mujahideens, who are part of the Naqshbandiya Sufi order. And they were in the early, for the Gailanis in the early 20th century, welcomed warmly to Afghanistan by the then ruler Amir Habibullah, who gave them land, for example, and a monthly allowance to settle. And for the Mujahideen, they established much earlier, actually already, their Sufi lodge in Kabul, and they became very influential religious family in Afghanistan that also was asked, for example, to perform coronation ceremony for the Durrani ruler Zaman Shah. And so, of course, this is a very well-known history that's also detailed by historians such as Walid Ziad. And they showed that actually in the study of these Naqshbandi and Mujahideen alliances, rulers, for instance, of like newly established states often lacked historical legitimacy, and they required the backing of spiritual institutions or of a spiritual institutional base. And they could draw on that as social capital. So there was kind of like a kind of symbiosis, as one might want to say. And this actually carried on in, you know, last decades, where, of course, you know, particular members of the Sufi families became ministers or intermarried with the royal family. And they were important in the political establishment in Afghanistan. And I think a lot of history has often focused on these families and the more politically visible Sufi groups. But then kind of like there's, of course, the second stance vis-a-vis the state, which is resistance. So Sufi communities have not only served as allies of the state, but also as key figures of resistance. And in many parts of the Islamic world, Sufis were known as critics of power. We know that, of course, from times of colonial expansion, when Sufi peers and brotherhoods were often one of the authoritative structures that were giving resistance actually to colonial powers. And this actually didn't end in the colonial period, but we also see this later on with critics of the Afghan state, such as in Afghanistan, Pir Allama Faizani, who was active in Afghanistan's political scene in 1950s to 70s, but also in the 1980s with the resistance against the Soviet-backed Afghan government, there were two of the resistant parties that were also led by Sufi peers. And I believe that the third kind of stance that Sufi leaders and communities could take towards the state, and what I call strategic distance, is a bit more difficult to trace because it doesn't directly come out of a direct alliance as being part of the state or a direct political stance. So Sufi communities have usually primarily existed as localized social groups, and they were usually affiliated to a particular Sufi teacher, a peer, or a high-ranking student, a khalifa. But they did not have necessarily an overt political affiliation to central government structures. So this is basically just a normal fact of these local groups' life, of how they just lead their life. But in moments when actually drastic political changes took place, this remoteness from power could also become a shielding mechanism, a way to stay apolitical, to be power avoidant. So there's different examples of that mainly actually came out of a lot of my interviews of the different communities. So it could mean avoiding interaction with government representatives or with insurgents. It could mean migration, either of individuals or of a wholesale community, and then reestablishing of particular teaching circles or of libraries in neighboring countries. It could also mean a discursive distancing. So a community could either self-censor, or they could stay away from voicing political opinions, or they could give depoliticized interpretations when they're speaking or they're publishing. They could also decline alignment with governments and say that they do not want to speak at a government event or they do not want to write poetry for a particular government. And so we see all of these three rough typologies surfacing in the history of Afghanistan. And of course, there would be much more to say about that, but maybe these examples already give a taste of the repertoire of these adaptations that these groups were engaged in.
Wonderful. The next question I want to ask you again is one of the key themes this book, which is trying to question the supposed and oftentimes supposed binary of Sufis and the ulama, or between, you know, Sufism and the Islamic legal tradition in the study of Central Asia and Afghanistan. Could you talk a little bit about how you question this often presumed antagonism between the ulama and Sufi masters, with the help perhaps of a case study that you talk about extensively in chapter 3?
Yeah, I think one of the difficulties when trying to look at actually the different Sufi groups is this idea of having these two different antagonistic groups, that being on the one hand, the ulama with imams and with, for example, the ulama council, and on the other hand, different Sufi groups. And this has been amply critiqued historically, of course, as there used to also be overlapping. So ulama used to also be Sufi peers and used to both actually give legal advice, as much as they were also engaged actually in activities that we would usually ascribe more into, you know, for Sufi communities and for Sufi teachers. But it's interesting that kind of in the last decades, of course, there is a kind of more like heightened bifurcation that we can see between these two different positions and how they're being stereotyped or how they're being cast. And in some cases, actually, that has led to Sufi communities themselves very self-consciously actually working with that. And one example for me is, which I've described in the chapter that you mentioned, is the Khanaka Pahlavan, which is one of the oldest Sufi lodges in Ashikan wa Arifan, which is an old part of Kabul. And this particular Sufi lodge had been led by one family over the course of nearly 200 years and given further from one teacher to another, but always kind of remaining actually within the same family. And during a period of time in which fighting intensified, particularly in Kabul, so this was kind of at the end of the Soviet-backed government of the PDPA in the end of the 1980s and then beginning 1990s, when different Mujahideen factions that had fought against the central government were starting to fight against each other, a period that also is then known as kind of a civil war period in Afghanistan, or often described as such. During this time, there was also a lot of fighting that happened in the vicinity of this particular Sufi lodge. And not only had some of the teachers before been threatened and imprisoned and targeted, but also then it just became too much for that family that had had this particular Sufi lodge. And so they decided to leave Afghanistan, like at that time, many Afghans who went to Pakistan or further as well to the West at the time. So the Sufi, the family left the Sufi lodge, but what they decided is to give the leadership of the Sufi lodge to an imam who had led his own mosque in a different part of town. His name was Haji Saikal. And he had known actually that particular Sufi lodge for many years since he was a little boy. So his father actually used to come to that Sufi lodge. And he was known by the community of who frequented this Sufi lodge as somebody who was trustworthy and somebody who would also maybe be better positioned or well positioned to take over this this position at this particular point in time. Because what was happening, of course, all over Afghanistan, also in Pakistan, was also a shift in general discourse about religious authority and who could be seen as a legitimate religious authority. And so him actually being an imam with his own mosque and madrasa had a particular standing and was recognizable in his particular role as an imam. So he actually took on also as the peer of that community, and he did both. And what he did actually then during the next decade and two was that he really shielded that community through his way of interacting with different power brokers who came and went in Afghanistan. So on the one hand, he interacted with different Mujahideen factions who were there. On the other hand, he also interacted then later with the Taliban when they were in power in the 1990s. And the Taliban at the time didn't have a particular national rule towards Sufi groups. But from time to time, they would maybe make moves to close the Sufi lodge. So what he would do actually was that he would talk with his students in his madrasa and figure out who would be closely connected to particular ministries of the Taliban to talk with them to keep the Sufi lodge open. So he very much embodied this kind of this double sense of, on the one hand, being part of the general ulama, but also actually being the peer of the Sufi lodge. And I found that that this was a way as well for me in my book then to talk a bit and to problematize this idea that these are two absolute separate realms that are also antagonistic to each other. Because in many instances where I went to different khanaqahs, to different Sufi lodges as well, I found that they were also led by imams who also had their own mosque, who actually were leading both at the same time. So these are actually not mutually exclusive roles to be had. And then I think it would serve generally well to reevaluate this idea of Sufism as being absolutely separate from otherwise Islam and from these other roles of the ulama, for example.
One other key theme that comes up in this book, especially in one of the chapters, is Sufi poetry. And what I really loved about this chapter is that you showed the not only the religious significance and history of Sufi poetry in Afghanistan, but also the sorts of changes and transformations that tradition has undergone over time, especially in the modern and contemporary periods. So I know it's a very big question I'm asking, but perhaps you could speak a little about the significance of Sufi poetry to Afghanistan, and what are some of the major changes that this tradition, and continuities for that matter, that this tradition has undergone in the modern and contemporary periods?
Yeah, it's a huge question, and I think actually one where we need even more research on and writing on in the future. So, of course, on the one hand, the importance of Sufi poetry in the religious and social history of Afghanistan cannot be stated enough. Sufi poetry has played an important part in Afghanistan's cultural and religious history. It's been a source of religious education and also a particular point of pride, as well as sometimes struggle in terms of cultural heritage. It might not become maybe directly apparent for a Western audience when reading Persian Sufi poetry in its English translation, but many of the phrases, of course, within the poetry come directly from the Quran, or they echo its spirit. So a telling example of The different readings and understanding of what Sufi poetry is might of course be, and that has been written about a lot already, the writing one of its most prominent exemplars of Jalaluddin Balkhi, or Rumi, as he is also known in the West. And he has of course produced some of the most, you know, important and beautiful poetry. In Afghanistan, his work is actually called the Quran in Persian. And this is the case because Maulana drew on something that Paul Nouria has called the Quranization of memory. So Quranic vocabulary not only colored these poetic expression and influenced the poetry, but also Sufis were able to understand everything in light of different Quranic sentences and could draw on it. And of course, Maulana Rumi, he was a scholar himself. And so a lot of historically Muslims in the Persianate world learned about Islam not only through the Quran and the Hadith, but also through poetry of Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafiz. So it was a regular component in madrasa education to, for example, read poetry collections such as Panch Ganj, like the Five Treasures, or Kuliyat al-Chahar Kitab, the Complete Four Books. And these were these poetry collections that were also taught in madrasas. So the anthropologist Niloufar Hariri, who works on poetry in Iran, of course, suggests that poetry is, on the one hand, religious ethical scaffolding for people's lives, but also an Islamic educational tool. And that was also the fact in Afghanistan, where classical poetry, that's also overwhelmingly steeped in Islamic mysticism, provided this important educational tool. Of course, some of that has been changing, as some of the poetry also has been cleansed from that particular madrasa education. But it used to be a big part of how people learned about Islam, and it became such a huge part, of course, of orality and making ethical judgments for people to actually see their lives through this poetry. And not only did a lot of people learn about this in schools, but also Afghanistan had particular poetry halkas, or poetry circles and meeting places, where Sufi poetry teachers would teach on the Sufi poetries. One example, of course, is Ustad Haider Wujudi, about whom I talk a lot in that chapter that you mentioned, who was also a public intellectual who stayed for over 5 decades in Kabul's public library and had a weekly teaching circle, for example. And it's also teachers like him who, of course, were wooed by different governments who tried to persuade him to maybe take an official government job or write in favor of the government. So different governments in Afghanistan were always very aware of how important actually Sufi poetry was and how much it actually mattered. And maybe one example that is maybe also interesting in terms of the dissemination and also the differences over various decades then in how poetry was disseminated and received is, of course, some of the collaborations that I describe in the book. So one example is the family of the Naqshbandiya Sufi teacher Kandi Ara and his family, who have been teaching and writing about mainly Bedil Dehlawi, who is a famous Sufi poet as well, not regarded by everybody as a Sufi poet, but who is also taught as a Sufi poet in Afghanistan. And they collaborated with Muhammad Hussein Sarahang, who is important and beloved musician in Afghanistan. He was classically trained in India. He was among the first and only artists permitted to perform live on air when Radio Afghanistan was established. And he then became famous for using Bedil poetry And in turn, also, of course, Bedl poetry and Sufi poetry became more widely known through him. So the dissemination through radio, through music, through song, and then as well, people listening to it and singing it and receiving it in that way, weaves another aspect into thinking of like how Sufi poetry is a part of everyday life as well in Afghanistan.
Turning to another theme that comes up in the next chapter, which is the question of female participation and, I guess, gendered participation in Sufi orders, especially the one that you focus on in this chapter, the Qadiriyya. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about, again, some of the ambivalence. I mean, that is a fantastic thing about this book, that each chapter basically, you know, presents to the reader a set of both potentialities but also ambivalences in relation to the theme that is discussed. So here again, I was wondering if you could speak a bit about some of the, you know, discursive and institutional means through which female participation in Sufi orders is legitimized, is authorized, and again, what kinds of ambiguities and ambivalences do we see in relation to that question?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So, of course, when I was researching, when I started to research, I realized that a lot of the Sufi orders were predominantly male, as was also the public Sufi sociosphere. And there were, of course, women in informal settings. Women were, of course, at shrines, also in the sphere of the household. So there was individual learning that was happening for women. But I was wondering whether women also were part of, you know, particular Sufi orders or could even teach or lead zikr circles as well. And in most of the different Sufi lodges and Sufi orders where I went, there was a general approach where the teachers or members said like, oh well, women can come, and if they come, they will be given the appropriate space, we'll make space for them. But it was not that I actually found women as actively teaching. And this was until I actually started researching with this particular Qadiriyya Sufi order with the Faizanis, where women actually not only learned and studied, but they also led zikr circles and they recited the Quran and they were teaching Sufi insights also to other female students. And I got curious about how it came about that in this particular Sufi order, one would have women teaching and what actually supported that. And the Sufi order, on the one hand, had particular, I would say, contemporary community practices that supported it, but also a particular discourse about gender or about women that supported the inclusion of women in teaching. And so this actually anchors in the founder's life, Allama Fezzani, who actively supported the inclusion of women, not only in learning, but also actually in teaching. So he was very active in the 1950s and 1960s. And he himself is often regarded as a kind of moral exemplar. So he lived actually in Afghanistan at a time when he was also very politically active. He himself got at some point imprisoned for his political activities. I can't get into that right now here, but you can read in the book. But he was a very interesting scholar and peer. He taught individual lessons on tafsir and Sufism and also regular Thursday evening classes on the Masnavi, on Maulana Rumi's work. And he actually also first included his wife. He taught his wife to read and to write, and then she actually began to give literacy classes to other women, whom she then also led in zikr circles. And there are many stories and memories that are connected to Allama Fezzani that are shared concerning his conduct with other scholars, his encounter later on with prison inmates whom he shared a cell with, but also his conduct with male and female murids, with students and on the Sufi path who were part of the community. And Alamef has any championed a particular discourse in his writing about the spiritual path, which then took root within the community as a particular approach to understanding spirituality. And one murid summarized it at some point to me in saying that it's not about either being a man or a woman on this path. It's about being human. It's not about the outer physical form that determines our own spiritual path, but it's about the ruh, the soul or spirit, the akal, so the wisdom or reason, and the kalb, the heart, that needs to be trained. And that actually wouldn't matter whether the heart resides in a male or a female body. And this is, of course, a departure from some approaches that either sketch women as spiritually inferior or in contrast as being exceptionally singled out as spiritual guides because of their gender and experiences, for example, as mothers, as we see in some other Sufi orders. And in contrast here in this community, actually, there is a particular discourse that spirituality transcends gender and should be understood as a non-gendered human endeavor. And so their own discourse of gender equality in the spiritual realm, and also actually to some extent of the unimportance of gender as a category on the spiritual path, then also justifies women participating, also leading zikr, Quranic recitation, or Islamic learning. And in this way, the whole discourse really focuses on the heart that is seen as the training ground to adopt particular postures and to train to be actually a good Sufi, to be a good believer as well. And this is then also supported structurally by what I would call male allyship. So male teachers, male students who also supported women on their path and also accepted them as spiritual equals as well. So it's not only that there is a generalized discourse, but also other community practices around that then support this particular approach.
Finally, I want to talk to you about the sort of last substantive chapter, which moves to the context of Herat, which is another key context in addition to Kabul for this book. And you talk about a certain succession debate among the Sufi community. And I was especially captivated by ways in which this whole debate about succession drew on and involved dreams and the oniric imagination. Could you speak a bit about this debate and the role of dreams in how this debate unfolded?
Yeah, it's a complex debate, actually. So when I came to Herat and started researching and interviewing murid, so students in this particular Sufi order, I directly came into a moment in which there was a succession debate. So it was already happening when I met the different Sufi teachers and students in that community. So 2 years before I came to Herat, the community had lost their teacher and leader, Pir Osman Maududi Chishti. And initially, actually, because his son was still alive, most on the outside of the group actually believed that he would inherit the father's position, because of course there's a lot of practicing of hereditary transmission of positions as well. But when I talked with the members of the group, they actually did neither see him as an automatic successor to his father, but actually they said that it's pretty open of who would actually become the next Sufi, the next leader of the community. And so I asked them, how will it be decided? Who will be the next teacher or the next leader in the community? And they said it would be decided through receiving a dream of the Prophet Muhammad. And this was quite striking to me. I mean, of course, I knew about the general importance of dreams within Islam, within, you know, most actually religious traditions, but I had not actually heard about this particular configuration of using dreams. So dreams are of course used to make many decisions. So there's practices such as istikhara that are used to induce dreams. So there's a session of, you know, like cleansing and preparing and setting an intention to then receive guidance through a dream, which is practiced quite widely, not only in Afghanistan, but also in the wider region. And of course, there is also, you know, many historic precedents where political leaders, such as Abdurrahman Khan in the 19th century, up until actually the Taliban leader Mullah Omar in the 1990s, justified their legitimacy as head of the Afghan state, for example, by declaring divine dreams that had predicted their success. But a lot of that actually has been a lot of that has been kind of after the fact. So these are a lot of times diaries that we have, or recordings, or writings after actually somebody has already taken up leadership. So this kind of reversal of having dreams as a part of this practice of figuring out who should be the next leader was quite striking to me. And so how this actually played out, on the one hand, it draws on particular underlying cosmology of that dreams have this ability to open up an in-between space, a kind of bazaar. And in this in-between realm of consciousness, our dreamers are more open to, you know, to the divine spirit, to also belief and existence of the power of prophetic dreams. So there's kind of this openness for meetings. And what happened in the community then is that two of the community teachers, or two of the community students who were also at the same time teaching in the community, they published a book about their own community, kind of like a history of their own community. And in the book, they detailed actually a lot of instances in which dreams had established certain decisions and had actually impacted the constitution of the Sufi community itself, their practices, and many different ways how they were deciding on particular decision-making matters. And when they published this community history, so this was self-published and then also distributed in Herat, for example, to the Ulama Council, or to also what was established at the time in Herat, which was so-called Sufi Council, which was a council of different Sufi groups in this civil society space. It kind of started a conversation about whether to decide on a leader through dreams, or how leadership should be decided on in the first in the first place. It started this conversation about that. And in actually then seeing how that unfolded, it was very interesting in seeing these processes on the one hand between the authors of this particular book and other people within the community who also saw the book itself as a kind of litmus test for potentially the authors as a kind of candidacy for leadership, but also then within the wider community. And what was interesting there was the wider Sufi community, so outside of the Sufi order. And hereby I mean, for example, the Sufi Council and the different other Sufi communities, Sufi orders, Sufi gathering places, also discussed the book and also had discussions about whether this was actually a right way to decide on a leader. And there was also criticism leveled against the community, but interestingly, not against the mechanism, not against using dreams to decide for leadership, but only about the fact that at that point in time, no leader had been decided yet, because basically a lot of the other Sufi teachers saw it as being wrongful for a Sufi order to be without leadership. So what was interesting in this whole navigation of this moment in which there was no leadership was actually that dreams, with their particular place within Islamic orthodoxy and within the cultural history of Afghanistan, had a very firm place, even in such a really insecure and difficult moment for this community. So it was actually a mechanism, a method that the community could draw upon for decision making, even though there was this contestation about what it then would mean in terms of who would become the next leader.
Sufi Civilities, Religious Authority and Political Change in Afghanistan by Professor Annika Schmiding, published by Stanford University Press in 2024. Thank you so much, Annika, for this outstanding book and for your time in talking about it with such insight and clarity. I really appreciate you being on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this was my conversation with Professor Annika Schmiding on her wonderful new book, Sufi Civilities. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to NBIS New Books in Islamic Studies. Bye.